if you can tell stories about Lake Wobegon to people from Lake Wobegon and have them believe you, even though you made the stories up, that's success. That's a home run for a storyteller. And I have had, occasionally, members of my immediate family call me after I've told a story that was a tissue of lies from beginning to end, and ask me if that really didn't happen. It's not a talent to admire or to recommend to children.
You are listening to Word of Mouth, a conversation in three parts investigating America's narrative tradition. Today's program, the last in the series, investigates the impact of the media and professional entertainers on the narrative tradition, asking, who is telling stories today?
There was always an uncle or a cousin or a father or a mother or a grandfather or a grandmother who was the storyteller, and people always used to love to listen to them, right? Now, I suppose, who's the storytellers these days?
Is there a family storyteller anymore? Well,
who's telling stories? We are told stories by professionals.
Instead of having, as there was in the old days, ordinary people singing and dancing and writing for themselves, we have slipped into a world in which everything is done by experts and by stars and by so-called spokespeople. They don't speak for me most of the time, and I do not think I'm alone in this. I think, you know, I'm one of the alienated multitudes.
Well, I was telling you the story earlier about Ben Guinea, a storyteller in Parks, a little town near here. He was, for years and years, the storyteller type guy who, when he, 50 years ago, when people had parties and they wanted some entertainment, they invited Ben.
I could tell jokes for 3 hours and never tell the same joke twice, you know. I could tell them almost for a day at one time. Now,
with the advent of television, radio and then television, Ben sort of lost his role as a storyteller in his community because, for a lot of reasons. One, people were comparing what he did to what they were hearing and seeing on radio and television, and finding it not as well prepared, not as slick, not as... Also, I think that people were fascinated with television and they began to look to it for storytelling.
We left the family storyteller a little while when the radio came along.
What evil lurks in the hearts of men? The shadow knows.
When I was a kid, and I was homesick, I would always listen to the serials on the radio, Captain Midnight and Bobby Benson of the B-Bar-B Ranch and the Green Hornet and Wonder Woman, and they would do for me what oral storytelling did for rural Southern kids. They would stimulate my imagination. I would listen to the words and the images, and I would create in my own mind my own pictures to go along with it.
Then came television, and this was a new kind of storyteller. You didn't have to do anything. You didn't have to work at it. You didn't have to use your imagination. You didn't have to guess how Br'er Rabbit and Br'er Fox looked, because there was Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck and Mickey Mouse and all of them doing their thing.
You know, I don't believe there's such a thing as TV. I mean, they just keep showing the same pictures over and over. And when they talk, they just make sounds that more or less sync up with their lips. That's what I think.
TV can be a great medium, but the purpose is to sell something.
So they can't take any kinds of chances. They can't be very daring. They also can't be too difficult for too many people to understand, so they have to be stories at the level of children's stories. They can't really deal in mature adult ways with choices and conflicts that arise.
When I come to school
and all the kids have seen a television show, and that suddenly has become part of their experience base. And the fact of that event links them together in a funny way, and if I didn't see it, I'm not. You know, it's like suddenly there's another kind of a community.
Oh, last night they were telling me, oh, I have to go home. I could hear it in a shopping center. Oh, girl, child, yeah, I got to go home because they're going to do something to one of them. I don't know. And then they're going to talk about it all summer. You know, did you see it? Oh, yeah, who killed him? I don't know, child, but I saw that gun coming around the door. That's going to be discussed all summer long.
And the kids say, you know, when that happened to her, that reminded me of a time when, and suddenly here comes a big story. You know, it's like you tell stories around the common experience base.
But I think as TV gives us images to be consumed, we're not nourished. TV gives us throwaway images. We can't remember from hour to hour what we saw. It has a numbing effect. And I watch a lot of TV, and I've analyzed my own interest in it. Why do I watch so much TV? But I know that when a TV program is served up to me, I'm supposed to consume it, excrete it, so that I can take in another program. So the images don't linger.
He can turn on a television and watch Three's a Crowd. It doesn't make any difference how stupid it is. You'll get some laughs out of it quick, and it's easy. And you don't have to put up with Grandma Simpkins, who's a wonderful storyteller, but sometimes it takes her a half a pint of whiskey and 2 or 3 hours to get going, and she drools. But for me, I'd spend the time for Grandma Simpkins. But
we got dreams, keep your eyes fixed on the screen, squeeze your life there in between.
There is so much media coming at you so often from the newsstands, and from there's so much electricity and radio and TV and news and magazines and bulletins and journals and classes, that in fact you could successfully, almost like hopping from one rock in a stream to another, to cross to the other side without ever touching another human being, just receiving it at arm's length or through some 527 lines on a tube.
There's a natural tendency of people to want to communicate, and once that's cut down, we become unnatural, we behave unnaturally.
A small child kept sort of standing up and getting closer and closer to me, and finally walked up to where I was, and I was separate from a standing in front of a seated audience, and he came up and touched my leg, and he turned back to his mother and he said, "Mama, he's round." He was reacting to me as a live human being, that his only acquaintance was seeing something that was entertaining for you or performing art for you was on television.
Maybe I live in the wrong community, but I don't get the sense that the fact that people here in Raven County watch more television than they've watched before has destroyed the community or the storytelling tradition. It's cut into the time you spend. But when people get together on Sundays, they still talk up a blue streak.
I think talking, the very act of talking out loud, is the greatest antidote, I think, for authoritarianism. And that's storytelling. I think talking out loud involves communication. So that means you're talking to somebody or to somebodies. When you do it, the very nature of community is strengthened, you see. Silence, the closed door. So what have we today? Along with TV, along with technology, we have a crazy world in which we live in fortresses. What's the concomitant of that? Silence. except for the sound of the TV coming through. You hear a scream, you can't tell it's a scream in the street, an actual scream of one on TV. But silence from you and from your neighbors is what it's about. The voices come from the box. So talking, of course, talking and walking. The greatest crime prevention is people on the street.
Of course, people don't walk like they used to. They jog, but they don't walk. People have television and air conditioning there. And people have moved away from the heart of town, so many of them. They're in suburban living.
You know, I say, when I tell them I can't drive a car, they look at me aghast, you know. I said, I never drove a car in my life, you know. And some wife and I, you know, my wife and I once walking, when I was doing the book on hard times, in a small town, it's a small town, Lamar's Isle, there was no sidewalk. We were at a Ma Pa Hotel, motel, you know, and I want to get some food. There was a hamburger joint about 100 yards down. So walking along the pavement, because there's no sidewalk, a police car pulls up from Lamar's. And I said, well, yeah, what we're doing? I said, we're walking. He said, you what? We're going to the hamburger place. Oh, okay. And they looked at us strange. Nobody walks. Even in small towns, that's what I'm trying to say.
Here's a little story that must be told.
About two cool brothers that were put on hold.
They tried to hold us back for fortune and fame.
They destroyed the crew and they killed the name.
They tried to step on the ego and walk on the pride. But true blue brothers stand side by side through.
Most traditional storytelling that goes on in our urban or suburban way of life is oriented toward briefer types of narratives. We have maybe somewhat less leisure time, or we utilize it in a different way than rural people did. And so the kinds of stories we tell tend to be either jokes with punchlines normally, or brief urban legends like the Vanishing Hitchhiker, like the Southern Fried Rat.
Page 2. Our For What It's Worth department understands that airline service in China remains pretty primitive. They have some Boeing 737 jets, but the schedules are staggered, reservations are uncertain, maintenance is at least imperfect. A couple of Americans, Heather and Don Lemon, flying Canton to Shanghai, when the co-pilot came back through the cabin to greet passengers. When he tried to get back up to the flight deck, the door was stuck. He grappled with the door, tugging and kicking for minutes before the pilot opened the door from the inside. What in the world is the matter, the pilot wanted to know. The door is stuck? What do you mean the door is stuck? Nonsense, the door is stuck. And the pilot came out and closed the door. And it was stuck. Now we've got both the pilot and the co-pilot locked out of the cockpit. There's more kicking and tugging and prying. Now that plane can fly on autopilot, but it needs human help when it comes time to land, and it's coming time to land. Finally, after minutes that seemed like hours, the stuck door came unstuck, and the crew went back to work, and the passengers resumed breathing. Paul Harvey. Good day.
Listen later today at 5:30 for Paul Harvey's rest of the story on the Skinny Bobby Harper Show.
I think people are beginning to recognize the need for something beyond information, which we get so much of in the print media and television.
I think also television has probably made us so hungry that there's such a metaphysical emptiness in us for real stories and for genuine stories, for authentic stories, for stories of true heroism. And I don't mean heroism in the cheap, shoddy, sleazy commercial garbage that's packaged and thrown at us. I think there's some deep revulsion and turning away from those as being our stories.
And that's why anywhere in the United States you say storytelling, the doors are torn down and the seats are filled. people want that. It's something inside that says, I just want to use my own imagination now. That's somebody else's writing. That's somebody else's imagination. Let me use my own. So the storyteller gives it to you, and you make your own pictures.
We're having people who are corporate leaders, businessmen, who want to learn more about how they can better communicate with other businessmen, or with their clients, or with their markets.
The preachers are the best public speakers in the country today. And Tammy Baker on PTL Club is the finest female storyteller in the country. And you give Tammy a check for $1,000, tears run down her face. And the ring of heart-wrenching sincerity, the deep mascara that she wears is so the back row of that huge audience can see the expressions on her face. And when the tears run, it pulls that mascara down. Not only does the back row of the audience can empathize with this because they can see it, but it's great on color TV.
Storytellers today are people from all walks of life and all ethnic backgrounds, all traditions. Many of them are librarians. Many of them are teachers who, because of their work in the library or work in the classroom, also are extending their work beyond the walls of the classroom and into the community. And that's what's happening in storytelling today. And where we had less than a dozen professional storytellers 10 years ago, there are probably now 300 or 400 professional storytellers, or people who tell stories for a portion of or all of their income.
I don't know what to call this phenomenon. I think it's a fascinating phenomenon. I've heard it called revivalist storytelling as opposed to traditional renaissance, if you will. But I think this phenomenon is very different from the traditional storytelling we've been talking about. This is a more professional situation, and it's a situation that arises out of a certain nostalgia for the past, and out of, it's a kind of romantic revival.
I have never been recognized by a person in a bowling alley. The day that I walk into a bowling alley and someone comes up and says, aren't you the guy from A Prairie Home Companion? Then I'll feel like the show is a big hit. I've never been recognized in a supermarket, except in certain kinds of supermarkets, which sell a lot of imported food, or backed by the whole grains sometimes. In the organic section, I've been recognized. I've never been recognized by anyone in the vicinity of frozen foods.
We had, more recently, another handicrafts revival movement. And I think, essentially, this storytelling revival movement is just a later extension of an appreciation for the grassroots qualities of folk culture, whether it be in song or handicraft or story.
It's accessible. You know, it's something that ordinary people can find, can make up, can locate and practice, just the way in the 60s, you know, every little kid learned again that he or she could play the guitar and sing. It didn't have to be art.
It was very much connected to this back to the roots, back to the earth kind of reaching for our own entertainment and saying, wait a minute, you know, I don't need to be force-fed everything that I get in the evenings or when I'm relaxing and enjoying myself. I can create some of this myself.
A mark of effective speaking is that when you start with some way of getting everybody's attention. And you don't say anything that they need to listen to the first few seconds. So I use a standard rip-tail roar that Davy Crockett and a lot of the folks in those days used to use when they were doing on the political stump before they had PA systems. It's, you know, I'm half horse, half alligator. Got a mouth chock full of bear's teeth. Jaw like a snapping turtle. A little bit of the devil's tail for a tongue. Well, that sets an audience up and focuses them.
I think that this revival of storytelling began pretty much in a library context. You had a lot of people learning stories to tell to children.
You know, in the 40s, when television started taking such a strong hold and people started really turning to the TV for the evening's entertainment, it was the libraries that kept alive storytelling. And so that I think it's been on the ground floor in some of this renaissance of storytelling that's going on now, so that people have had a bit of role model of here is a place where you tell stories and here's a place where you listen to stories.
Moral of this tale?
Moral of this tale?
Don't go looking for trouble.
Don't go looking for trouble.
Till trouble comes looking for you. Leave well enough alone.
Leave well enough alone.
The end.
The end.
Give yourselves a round of applause.
So I remember my grandmother's house. When I was a little kid, I saw a picture, and I asked her what that, and it was Homer telling stories to a bunch. It's a famous old lithograph that was in many homes in the 20s and 30s. Mm-hmm. And it's Homer, I'm sure it's an old painting, telling stories, you know. I mean, what is older than that, you know? I mean, Moby Dick, you know? I alone have escaped to tell thee, right? You know, and we're considered avant-garde in New York. It's so, they list us in the Village Voice as performance artists.
Very few of the participants in this movement are really traditional storytellers. And the context in which they tell the stories is very different from the traditional context.
I've been speaking finally to some agents and lawyers after all these years, as somebody noticed that I exist, which is typical for show business, you know. They discover you like Columbus discovered America, you know, as if it weren't there for...
CBS cable television has been interested in doing my stories, and they showed me some footage of other so-called storytellers.
This series will be sold to libraries, school libraries all over the country. So there should be some good royalties coming out of this one.
I usually ask for only a modest fee, if any, in Annapolis just for expenses, because I do feel very strong it's a moral issue that these stories don't belong to me. I just happen to be right now the curator.
Probably be a major market within a couple of years for storytellers.
They're now telling them to large audiences of children or adults. Many of these people are kind of self-taught. They get their stories from printed sources, most commonly, or their own imaginations. And they're developing performance skills very much of a theatrical nature, and drawing a lot of their techniques from the theater.
I think I'm the first person that I know of that is just really, that I've encountered, that's just taken myself as material. And have decided that it's my stories that I want to tell from my specific home of Barrington, Rhode Island. When I tell the stories from my life, I see a film of the event, and I describe the film. It's quite a direct, I see the image in my head, and I simply follow that. So when I'm telling, recounting a story that's handed down to me, there's a double distance there that I don't like, I don't feel as energized by, and I don't think the audience does either.
I don't know about your dreams, but mine are sort of hackneyed. Same thing night after night. Just repetitive. And the color is really bad. And the themes are just infantile. and you always get what you want. And that's just not the way life is.
I think also it's a reaction against our electronic, impersonal approaches to entertainment. It's an attempt to get back to more of a one-on-one relationship between an entertainer and his audience.
A friend was telling me about it this summer. He'd been to Africa, and he visited a village where they just put electricity in, and they had a community television set. And nothing went on in that village for about 2 weeks, except the whole tribe glued in front of the TV set. And then they got sick of it and never watched it anymore. And he was a little puzzled, and he asked this one man in the tribe, he said, "Well, tell me, why is it you don't watch the TV anymore?" "Oh, we don't need it," the man said. "We have the storyteller." And the man said to him, "Well, don't you think the television set probably knows more stories than your storyteller?" And he said the man looked at the ground, and he thought for a while, and then he looked up with a huge grin on his face. And he said, "Oh, yes, the television knows many stories, but the storyteller knows me."
This thing I was telling you about in parks was very interesting. When radio and television came to, radio and television crews came to record Ben Guinea telling stories out on his porch, and then people in his neighborhood saw this big television truck with two, three radio television cameras around and filming him from all these angles and getting him to tell stories, and a big fuss being made over him. They apparently took another look at him and said, "Well, what in the world are they doing paying attention to all that stuff that we try in earnest to avoid every day?" And that whole experience caused his neighborhood to rethink his worth, and he is now once again an important person in his neighborhood, oddly enough, because of television, which had taken away his role as storyteller in the first place, gave him back a sense of importance in his community because he was a storyteller and they came to document it. So it's kind of an interesting reversal of roles there.
And I really don't think that this is just the kind of revival that's going to come in a wellspring now and then die right back out. I think we have just reached back and grabbed hold of what is our birthright, and I think we'll continue with it being just as strong.
My brother's doing fast on my mother's TV. Says she watches too much. It's just not healthy. All my children in the daytime, Dallas at night. Can't even see the game or the Sugar Ray fight. The bill collectors, they ring my phone and scare my wife when I'm not home. Got a bummed education, double-digit inflation. Can't take the train to the job. There's a strike at the station. Neon King Kong standing on my back. Can't stop to turn around. Broke my sacroiliac. A mid-range migraine, cancer, membrane. Sometimes I think I'm going insane. I swear I might hijack a plane. Don't push me. Call. I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
Word of Mouth was written and produced by George King for WRFG-FM, Atlanta, Georgia. Today you heard, in order of appearance, author-broadcaster Garrison Keillor, performance artist Mike Fader, storyteller Jackie Torrance, author-broadcaster Stutz Terkel, anthropologist Barbara Meyerhoff, folklorist Barry Anslett, storyteller Alex Jiwa, folklorist John Burrison, musician Tommy Thompson, educator Elliot Wigginton, writer Gurney Norman, poet author James Steele, storyteller Connie Regan Blake, Storyteller, Chuck Larkin. Storyteller, John Spellman. Archivist, Dick Allen. Broadcaster, Paul Harvey. Actor, Corey Fisher. Director of the National Association for the Preservation and Perpetuation of Storytelling, Jimmy Neal Smith. Performance artist, Spalding Gray. And storyteller, Ron Evans. Funding for this series was provided by the Humanities Council's Endowments and Committees of Georgia, Alabama, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Tennessee, with additional funding from the City of Atlanta's Bureau of Cultural Affairs and the Georgia Council for the Arts. The principal humanities consultant for the series was Cliff Kuhn, production assistant Louise Bloom. I'm Walt Elder. If you have enjoyed Word of Mouth, you are invited to write to your local state humanities council or committee to inform them of your interest.
In earlier days, when Ben came into the grocery store or to the little club where he hangs out in parks, people would turn their backs or get in, you know, start up a conversation so that they didn't have to talk to him because they knew he was going to launch into his what they call nonsense. And now they actually go up and turn off the radio or television and encourage him to tell the stories that they had tried to avoid earlier, because he is once again considered, if you will, a cultural hero.
Cassette copies and transcriptions of this tape are available from WRFG-FM, P.O. Box 5332, Atlanta, Georgia, 30307.